Hello, this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition. Enough is enough. Well, Manton Reese, I am I'm going to say your full name because that's my habit. Manton Reese, I am sitting here looking at my Xcode. Of course, it's Swift I'm using because it is, you know, 2014. Let's not live in the past. And every time Apple updates now their Xcode 6 developer preview, I go back into my one project that has one Swift file, and I build and run, see what broke, fix it. And when I can, I look at the Swift release notes and see, okay, was there something I was complaining about that is now addressed? And it so happens something I complained about on the show here with you was this like really convoluted thing I felt that I had to do to set the key equivalent modifier mask on an NS menu item. And it was like based in the fact that, you know, being a real fancy language, Swift like doesn't just have a, you know, pound define for every constant, like everything's namespaced. So in Swift, whereas, you know, we used to have NS command key mask or something, now it's like NS event modifier flags dot command key mask. And if you command double click on that NS event modifier flags, it takes you to, I don't even know if these are headers, but it takes you to the Swift equivalent of a header. And it shows you, you know, very precisely what this thing is. And it's like, it's a struct in Swift. So that's like, you know, one of these class-like things in Swift. So you can actually, you know, have functions on it, methods rather. But my problem before was I couldn't for the life of me figure out an easy way to just or, you know, do the equivalent of what you do in Objective-C to OR the bits of these things together. And it was because, you know, fundamentally ORing, you know, integers together essentially is such a low-level thing that working with these higher-level things, you know, now it's not just an integer, it's a struct that has all these static variables for all the different constants. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm going on and on. But the bottom line is they added something that caught my eye in the latest developer preview, which was they said, you know, so if you go in and look at this thing, it's actually a struct that inherits from something else called raw option set type. And then raw option set type is a protocol. I guess it doesn't inherit from it then, but it implements raw option set type. And raw option set type, in turn, implies these other protocols, including now, they've added one, bitwise operations type.
Huh.
And then if you double-click on the bitwise operations type, it shows that it is a protocol. And I don't really know much about what I'm looking at here, Manton, because I haven't bothered to do the bare minimum of education about Swift. I just dive in instead and complain about things. but it's kind of cool. You can browse in and you can see the list of functions that this protocol, bitwise operations type, offers. And among them, of course, are a function, operator overload function for AND, for the vertical, you know, pipe, and for mm-hmm. the caret, all the stuff you'd expect for bitwise operations. Huh. So there's also like a little convenience thing here. Like there's like this all zeros. I don't know what that does. Oh, okay. See, it has, I don't know. There's like a little, it's kind of cool because the fact that they make these things into kind of full class, you know, class-like things, you can have these little convenience methods on there in addition to doing things like operator overloading. Anyway, bottom line was I was able to reduce my heinous like conversion of the masks to ints and then ORing them and then converting them back to something. I don't know. It's still more verbose. So this is so funny. It's still more verbose than Objective-C, which is of course what I thought we were supposed to be getting away from. But it's a lot nicer now. Now I say, I actually declare a local variable, new flags, and I say that that is NS event modifier flags dot command key mask ORed with NS event modifier flags dot control key mask. And then, but what I'm left with then is not an integer that I can pass off to the key equivalent modifier mask. It's, of course, one of these fancy structs. So I have to then take that new flags struct, call its toRaw, method and then initialize an int with that. So it's still a little convoluted, yeah, but
still sounds clunky, but it's better than it was.
Better than it was. And this is just another example of trying to sort of bridge a high level type language to something that really expects a low level, you know, idea. Like the fact that you set a key modifier mask with an integer is a low level idea that's based in, you know, history where that was the right. most obvious way to do that.
And nowadays it's very uncommon for a new API to do this.
Yeah.
It just doesn't really, it doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Right, the efficiency
gained by trying to squeeze flags together into, you know, one little short end or something doesn't really matter anymore.
Well, that was kind of scary there, Manton. We almost talked about programming on the Core Intuition show.
I was just listening to you because I have been almost completely unplugged. And so I didn't even know there was a new build. It seems like I would have noticed this, but I didn't even know there was a new developer release. I definitely didn't read the doc. So I'm counting on you for the first 5 minutes of our show every week to tell me what's new in Swift. So does it feel like the changes are slowing, or they just keep coming with, you know, Swift changes, compiler changes? Because the reason I ask is I wonder, we're very close now to what Swift 1.0 is going to be. And I wonder if the team at Apple is going to have a hard time slowing down and saying, yeah, we're done, instead of keep every, you know, 1.0 ships and then, oh, no, we still want to make more changes and more changes.
Well, it sure feels like things are still changing quite a lot to me. And it seems like the scale of the changes, to be honest, this is the one thing I noticed most of all in this latest release. So I don't have it on the tip of my tongue what else was changed. But I'm curious about what you just said, Manton, that you declared with some confidence that we are close to Swift being a 1.0. And was there something that Apple said that makes you think that? Or is it just because you're sort of assuming that it would come out with iOS 8 and with Yosemite?
Yeah, I'm assuming it will come out with iOS 8 or Yosemite, whichever ships first. I assume iOS 8 will ship first, and I assume it will be soon, like in the next month or so, which, you know, month and a half. They have to ship Xcode 6 with iOS 8 so you can submit apps. I'd be very, very surprised if Xcode 6 doesn't GM a week or two before iOS 8 comes out.
You're right, but there is a great amount of precedence for Apple shipping non-beta Xcodes with beta less than fully supported compilers. So, like, remember LLVM was in the sort of tentatively supported column for years, I think. And it wasn't until finally they said, okay, now after years of using LLVM, now I can use LLVM 1.0. I think that was the case.
Right. I guess I got the impression. Yeah, you're right. And most of us, I think, ignored LLVM for a while, really.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there was at the time I was working on a big C++ project, and it's like, that stuff just is not going to compile right off the bat. Usually you're going to have to make some tweaks. And so no, we'll stick with GCC. Actually, the same kind of thing happened in the MetroWorks to Xcode transition. It's like, you kind of want to sometimes stick to the old stuff until you finish moving over. But with Swift, I got the impression that they want people to ship apps with this thing, but please don't do that until 1.0 is ready.
Right.
And think of all the developers that are playing with this. You are, obviously, but there's tons of people that are not just playing with it, but adding features and building apps with it. If they can't ship an iOS 8 app written in Swift when iOS 8 comes out, that's going to be a big problem, I think.
If they can't ship an Swift app this year, it's going to be an opportunity for me to say, I told you so.
Right. That just seems impossible. Like they're going to have to make it 1.0 when iOS 8 comes out. And even if it's not ready, they're going to have to call it 1.0, because either that or say you can distribute apps to the App Store that were written in a beta programming language, which I don't see happening.
I don't think that – I'm not as convinced unless they said something that is slanting your thinking towards it being a priority for them. I haven't gotten the memo that there's an urgency for Swift.
Well, here's from the Swift page I'm looking at now. You know, it coexists with Objective-C, blah, blah, blah. And when iOS 8 and OS X Yosemite are released this fall, you can submit your apps to the App Store and Mac App Store.
Well, there you go. That's it.
You got to be able to. And so it's got to be 1.0. So it just seems like they need to wrap up at some point. You know, it's like shipping any 1.0. At some point you have to say enough is enough, you know, get it out the door, even if you want to spend the rest of the year adding features and fixing bugs and tweaking stuff.
Yeah, but that's a lot. Geez, I don't envy anybody at Apple who is possibly working under the gun on something as important as Swift. Working under the gun to get it out by a deadline sounds like a really, it sounds like a bad idea, doesn't it? I mean, this is this is something
this is pretty important.
Yeah, it sort of affects, you know, but yeah, I think they could also release it and say it's not beta, but also say it's still going to keep changing. Maybe not even call it 1.0. I mean, we were in perfectly allowed to use LLVM before. I think they called it 1.0. And it was encouraged.
That was kind of like before the Mac App Store and, right? I mean, that was a long time ago where they couldn't, they didn't have the same like tight control over the process of shipping apps that they do now.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, you might be right. It was just kind of like, yeah, well, it seems to work, so ship it. Yeah, with Swift, though, it's going to be different, of course, because for the backwards compatibility, you're going to have to ship with the Swift libraries and everything bundled in the app. And so it's like there's no sneaking by. There's no just saying like, well, this is just a fancier compiler. Like, you know, it just produces machine code differently than the previous one. There's going to be real obvious that an app has some Swift dependency.
Yeah, but again, though, the nice thing about that approach is I could ship a Mac app today. Apple probably would prefer I didn't, but I could ship a Mac app directly to customers today that use Swift, and it will keep working on 10.9 and 10.10, I think. And so that's nice. And then I can update to the new Swift stuff when I want to, but I don't think anything will break because of the way they include the libraries.
You're right. The thing that they warned against was that if you are getting into the business of providing libraries to other Swift apps, that's where you can expect things to break moving forward. So as long as your Swift app is a self-contained thing that just consults its own library, then I think you just keep expecting that to work as you would expect any compiled software to work.
Well, that's cool. I've been very disconnected. I've kind of unplugged a little bit for the last, you know, week and a half, 2 weeks. We've been on vacation. I have had to code a little bit, and I have had to read email every day, unfortunately, and respond to things and fix little problems here and there. But I haven't actually messed with Swift at all in the last 2 weeks. But I don't know. Apple keeps they're not waiting for me to get back to my computer to code.
Apple's going to go ahead and move on with life without Manton Rees.
It's so funny to see Apple. That's such a big company now. I think I say this all the time, but it's so neat to just see everything they're doing. I went to the New York City Apple store on Fifth Avenue, and it's so Apple. I love, you know, obviously they have tons of money, but they also have style and passion for creating like a space that is really cool. So like they could have opened an Apple store in any stupid little mall or strip mall or something, but no, we want this giant glass cube that you go in and then descend, you know, under the ground, either the glass elevator or the staircase, and then you got this huge Apple store underneath. I don't know. They're so good at creating just these nice spaces.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you know, Apple stores can be pretty darn boring. Like, they're still nice even when they're boring, like the ones in the malls, but they can be very rectangular, simple, you know, the straight like mall rectangle with a bunch of nice tables and genius bars, kind of the lowest common denominator of Apple stores, right?
But and ours in Austin are fairly boring by Apple store standards.
So, you know, I've never actually been in that Fifth Avenue Apple store. I'm not a religious person, you see. but how was it? So, were you impressed? I know it looks impressive from the outside, but when you go down inside,
I mean, when you go down inside, I guess it's just any other Apple store, although it probably was the biggest I've ever been in. It's pretty big. It's definitely twice as big as the ones in Austin. Hmm. But yeah, I mean, once you go down there, I mean, they've got Macs, they've got iPods, basically the same. But I love the entrance and just the thought that goes into creating a space like that just looks very cool. And and it's also practical because building a store above ground that large wouldn't have worked very well. So right. they can have this cool cube above and then the larger space below.
There must be like an intense air circulation system or something. It's like, it's kind of like a subway, right? It's like, you ever think about that? Right. Like how am I getting air down here? Oh yeah. They have like huge air pumps and fans and all that business. But in the Apple store, they must have to do that as well, but it must just be silent because, you know, Apple couldn't have like big honking fans going.
It's just like their computers.
So there's just this like
fans.
I've got an idea for a store. I better not do any accents.
almost got it. Yeah. One of the things I love about New York is the underground spaces. Actually, we were in Montreal after that too, and it's the same kind of thing. Lots of stuff underground, yeah. Like the underground city, quote unquote, and of course subways. But yeah, in New York, I don't think they have. You say that they figured out the air circulation, but yeah, it depends on the subway station. I'm not sure they figured that out. But I love, for coming from Texas, where nothing is underground ever. Like we don't even have basements. You know, you just don't dig stuff here. It's cool to go to a city where there's so much happening kind of below the surface.
You mean there's no basement in the Alamo?
No, I don't think so.
No. Pee Wee Herman reference. Well, Manton, this is an unusual week for us because we have a very special sponsor indeed. It is a little innovative job site called Core Intuition Jobs. Have you heard of it?
I have heard of that thing. I think it's the best place to find, you know, quality Mac and iOS.
Everybody knows it, so it almost doesn't seem worth advertising. However, something Manton and I have actually noticed, it's been 6 months since the Core Intuition Jobs site was launched. And of course, we've been thrilled with the response we've seen both from employers and from employees or candidates who are looking for great new COCO jobs. But I have to admit, and we have to admit, that it has slowed down a bit recently. And we think it's not because it isn't still a great service that offers something that, you know, lots of people, lots of employers, lots of candidates need. I think it's just kind of passed a little bit out of the mind share recently. So what we want to do is we want to devote this week's sponsorship here on the show, a show which, as you're listening to it, we know you love. We want to devote the sponsorship to our own service. And we also want to celebrate the fact that we've been running the site now for 6 months by going back and commemorating that with a special 1 week 50% off offer. So the normal price to list a job on the job site is $200. And for 1 week from the release of this episode, we will be offering that listing for $100. So it's a great opportunity if you are an employer or if you work somewhere where you know, frankly, they could use some great new teammates to help get the job done. Nudge your employers to take advantage of this offer. Get the job site kind of like a kick in the pants here, and I think we'll help make sure that it continues to be a very pertinent resource for COCO developers on both Mac and iOS.
Check it out. Check out the jobs that are there, and hopefully your company will be a good fit for the board. And if you have any questions, you can email jobs@corent.org or our usual feedback@corent.org email address, and we'll help you with it. And every listing also goes out to Twitter, app.net, and Facebook. So if there's a job like from a few months ago that's not listed on the main page anymore because it's not recent, you can go back through the feed and see some other people who have listed. A lot of really great companies have been listing on the jobs board, and hopefully yours is going to be one of the next ones.
All right. Thanks again to those crazy guys at Core Intuition Jobs for sponsoring the show.
And it's jobs.corent.org. Okay. Well, this week we wanted to follow up a little more on previous discussion about the App Store and pricing. And there was some comments in the Core Intuition Glassboard, which if you haven't joined yet, feel free to jump in and add comments or post topics in there. The invite code is coreint on glassboard.com. And there were some comments, and one of them was like, U.S. developers just in general have a high cost of living, you know, compared to, you mentioned, India, Northern Ireland. And so this, you know, the Jared's, you know, quote unquote failure, that money actually in other parts of the world would be great. Huge success, good salary. One of the things that's happened in the last, I don't know, week or so, maybe a bit since we last talked about this, is Jared actually has kind of, you know, not just said that this didn't work out as well as I wanted, and I'm going to keep going, but this didn't work out as well as I wanted, and I'm going to take a full-time job working for somebody else and getting a steady paycheck and not adding any new features to Unread, his other apps, just kind of maintenance mode. Going to do bug fixes and compatibility stuff, but basically he gave it everything he had for a year, and now it wasn't enough. I'm going to, you know, take a regular job.
So good for Jared if this is what he needs to do. And you know, there's a lot of value in a regular paycheck, literally. But the unfortunate thing for me is now my real life science experiment of whether, you know, slow and steady wins the race, so to speak, with Unread, whether that will pan out. Like my advice, you know, not directly to him, but my sort of just like reflection upon the situation was, I thought $40,000 in a year was a pretty darned great start for a 1.0 app. And I speculated that continuing to evolve the app, releasing a 2.0, releasing a 3.0, that the number surely would go up over the years from $40,000 in 1 year. Sure, you know, there's no guarantee it's going to just always go up, but I thought it was pretty likely, for example, that cranking away on that app, and let's say the end goal was to have have that be your full time income. I was and am pretty convinced that the app is, you know, has had enough a popular enough of a start that it wouldn't be unrealistic to make $60,000 off of it in the next year, and that's still, you know, in a lot of places in the U.S. Cities in particular, big cities, that's not considered like a great amount of income by a lot of people, but that's getting up where you start thinking, hey, maybe this could be my full-time job, right? I mean, I think on average, if you ask people in the United States, you said if you could make $60,000 a year doing something, that's not considered chump change anymore. That's considered like in the realm of salary money.
Well, and it's in the realm too where you could supplement it with client work and consulting and stuff. You know, get up to where you really want it to be. And I think Jared did do some. I noticed on his website when I was kind of poking around the other week, I noticed he does do some work for clients, or at least had, you know, services available saying, you know, this is how much I charge and I'd be happy to work on your design or your app or whatever. So maybe he had some of that, but yeah, I don't know. You know, it's like some people love doing client work and, you know, working on lots of new apps frequently. You work on this month, you're working on these two apps, and then you wrap them up. And then a couple months later, you're working on something brand new for a customer and you pass it off and you don't have to worry about it anymore. But some people love that. And some people, that's just not their idea of fun. And they want to just focus on one thing that's theirs or working for someone else, but for over a long period of time, not just kind of like these quick get into the app store and then give the code to someone else kind of projects.
Yeah, you know, there's something else that this reminds me is it's all well and good to say, oh yeah, just now that you've done the 1.0, now just do a 2.0 and then just do a 3.0. Yeah. Like there's a huge amount of labor, but also like psychic cost, right? It's just like you get to the end of the 1.0 and you're kind of just like you put your last ounce of energy into it. And then maybe the last thing you want to hear is, okay, well, that wasn't as good as you expected. That's okay. Just do that whole thing over again. And, you know, I used to joke about Mars Edit because it's such a kind of complicated, I mean, the task that Mars Edit sets out to solve, which is, you know, as you know, to support a variety of blogging platforms from a unified UI. That goal is so actually, when it comes down to it, difficult that I used to joke, and maybe I wasn't even joking. I used to say that, you know, I sort of thought Mars Edit had to be a tag team style project. Like that is to say, you know, I couldn't fault Brent for, you know, maybe not wanting to go beyond the 1.0. Once he got it to 1.0, it's like all this work had gone into it, and all of this, you know, designing how the APIs are going to be sort of like in you know, factored into common code, factored out where it should be, and trying to adapt all these different systems with their little quirky details into one UI. And then, you know, I worked on Mars Edit from, you know, 1.1 through today, but I remember thinking, gosh, if I had done all this hard work of getting 1.0 out, I don't know if I'd have any energy left to do the 2.0.
Right. It's funny. You said tag team, and I thought, so you said, you know, Brent worked on it and then passed it to you, but
right
before you explained that, I was thinking you meant more than one person working on it at the same time. And an app like Marzite, I think, actually lends itself to that fairly well, because you do, like, I don't know about in the code base, but at some level it's modular enough where in theory someone could write support for a new blogging system without having to understand the full app.
Right. And that's sort of the goal. That's the more you actually factor it out well, the more possible that is. Now, the truth is there's a ton of little special cases everywhere, but there is some effort at least to make that goal attainable.
Yeah, we have that same thing in Sunlit. You know, it started as app.net only, and then we split some things out at the code level and added support for Flickr for some things, but not everything. And I see the next version, the version after that, that process will just, I don't know, just kind of become almost more like a plugin model where you could, like, in theory, we could pass it off to someone else to just write support for uploading to, you know, whatever.
Right.
I don't know, S3 or publishing like a Flickr set or something like that we don't support. In theory, you could split it out that way. And so, you know, tag team by,
right,
and scale, you know, by being able to pass off parts of the code to other people.
Absolutely. The whole idea of plugins is such a great idea in so many ways. It's too bad, for instance, on iOS, you can't really do it. You can't use plugins per se because, you know, you're not supposed to download code and run new code in your app. But on Mac OS X, it's a really great option for sort of building a platform that then other people really help you to flesh out the usefulness of. Great example that comes to mind is TextMate. You know, it was just a pretty simple little text editor. But right. One of the things people appreciated about it, I think, was the extent to which it could be extended, and the fact that so many people had made useful extensions to it. So I don't know. But getting back to Jared, it's just too bad all around that this app seems like Unread had opportunity, and you say you love the app, Manton.
It's on my home screen,
and you are going to now have to look forward to no new features.
Right, and like I said last week, you know, I thought it was remarkable that he did as well as he did, considering it was, you know, straight out of the 1.0, had really no features that other apps didn't have,
right,
in terms of the competition. It just was, it was designed in a different way, and it had very strong opinions about how you should read blogs and organize blogs. And that enough was special enough that people loved it. I love the app. It's great. Yeah. But yeah, so already he started at a disadvantage, which didn't really have any significant new features. And now there's no chance of new ones happening. And I will keep using it because I love it, but I have a bad feeling that when people find out that it's basically in this kind of maintenance mode, they will not want to buy it, because to them it's a dead product.
Yep.
And, you know, we see the same thing. App.net is a perfect example of this, actually. People left, you know, the service left and right when Dalton posted about the State of the Union, about how we had to lay people off and it's just in maintenance mode. If he hadn't have said anything, those people would still be on app.net. But the fact that they thought it was a dead product now,
right,
you know, it's still running fine, right? But because of that post, people lost all faith that it was going to ever get better. And so, I think the same thing could happen with Unread, unfortunately.
It seems guaranteed now with Unread.
Yeah.
It's who in their right mind would, I mean, well, I shouldn't
spend
say that.
$3. You're never going to get that $3 back.
I mean, I shouldn't say that. Everybody in their right mind should definitely buy it today if it does what they want today. And it sounds like it really does for a lot of people. So definitely, you know, buy it, use it, enjoy it. But it's inescapable, this expectation that customers have that software has the potential to continue evolving. And that's, you know, one of the exciting things about software. You can appreciate and accept that you really do only get what you pay for today, but then you kind of like look forward to, it's just like an iPhone, for instance, too. I mean, I like my iPhone, but am I excited about a new iPhone 6? Yeah. Am I excited about iOS 8? Yes. It doesn't mean that, you know, I'm not getting a lot of what I expect from the current stuff, but if Apple were to say, oh, we're going out of business, there's never going to be another iPhone again, same thing would happen. People go, okay, well, I guess I better invest in Android, as poor of a fit as that may be to some people. They would still say, well, I got to go with something that has a future. Now, the problem, Manton, with this Jared Sinclair situation is I don't think I have another example of an app that's done so well in the first year that I can now watch and point to and say, see, when he did the 2.0, he made $60,000 a year, because next year, Unread is not going to make $60,000 now.
Nope. Yeah, there's no way. And because there won't be anything to get press about. There won't be any of those, you know, moments we talked about where you can get another little spike,
yeah,
or at least have a kind of a steady increase. It's just way too difficult. And you know, I get email, like some of my apps, I don't mean to abandon them. I haven't posted to my blog that I'm abandoning them, but some of them have seen updates so long ago that I get emails from customers. You probably have seen this same thing with some of your apps. Like, is this supported anymore?
Yep.
And I always have to say, like with ClipStart, yes, I've been working on it. It just 2.0 is like a year and a half late, but it is totally supported. I do respond to the emails about it. I will try to help you. Yes, there are parts of it that have not aged well. You know, some parts of it work great. Some parts of it should have had an update 6 months ago. But yeah, people don't want to spend $29, certainly. And I think people are so cheap in the App Store, they may not want to spend even $3 if they don't think the app has a future. You know, the App Store, it incurred the updates happen so frequently and so automatic with the iOS App Store. People really like to see new versions. And I think you can overdo this, but it reminds me, there was this blog post that I saw linked on the iOS Dev Weekly email newsletter. And I haven't actually read it yet, but the title was Ship Your App Weekly. You know, why feedback is more important than perfection. And so you can kind of get an idea what the post might be about.
Yeah.
But the gist of just like iterating very quickly, and that's a sign to customers that you care and you're making your app better.
Yeah.
And I've seen this just recently with Tweet Library. I mentioned, you know, fixing some crashing bugs and adding some small things. And the app hadn't seen an update in, let's say, 4 or 5 months. And then it saw maybe 3 or 4 updates over the course of a few weeks or a month. And they were minor, but it felt like it mattered. Like I was getting replies on Twitter that like, oh, this app is great. You know, you're just seeing more activity from customers.
Yep. Yeah. It goes back to that idea of sort of being able to simulate the excitement that surrounds the debut. Kind of funny. It's sort of what we're trying to do with our sponsorship this week with the job site. It's like we want to simulate some of that original launch hoopla. And you get a lot. You don't get a lot of that when you just ship a bug fix update. You know, when you shipped your latest update, it wasn't like, woohoo, you know, call Macworld, call, you know, all the sites, call iMore. Get Federici on the line. It was
you're gonna stick with that.
Yeah, and but you get enough of those little updates, it just starts to be kind of like, well, you know, how many of those little updates does it take to add up to the hoopla of one big update? I don't know, 50 maybe, like 50 little bug fix updates. And so if you do this what this guy's recommending and ship your app every week, well, you sure are gonna stay at the top of the what's new lists, right?
Yeah, well, I don't even know, though. There's so many. It used to be in the App Store, if you shipped often enough, you were, like, you almost featured, right? Because it was, like, sorted by most recent versions. And so if you shipped a new version every week, you would poke up there and be more discoverable. I don't think that's the case anymore. I don't think it really matters from a, you know, discoverability standpoint.
Yeah, there are still other, of course, venues for advertising apps availability. So I notice whenever I update, for example, I put it on sites like Mac Update and stuff like that, and then they end up tweeting like all of their new app releases, and then other sites just like pick up and mirror their stuff. And so there's still some amount of like buzz you can generate just by merely releasing a bug fix update.
Yeah. All right. Well, obviously, we wish, you know, Jared the best of luck with this. It would have been nice to have another year of Unread so he could do another chart and say, you know, this is what I did and this is how it looks in another 6 months or year. But it's not going to happen. So I don't know. Where's that money going to go that Jared's leaving on the table because he's not going to do a 2.0?
Right into my pocket, Manton, because One thing I plan on doing is shipping software this year, or next year, or maybe the year after that. But one of these years, one of these years, I'm definitely going to make $60,000. And here's a proposition for Jared Sinclair. We'll have to send it to him directly on the off chance that he's not listening to this right now. You know, I mentioned how it's going to be disappointing for people, including yourself, Manton, that Unread, an app that they've been impressed by and are inspired to have on their home pages, will not be meaningfully developed after Jared takes this new job. So getting back to the idea of tag teaming, maybe Jared needs to find a Red Sweater Software type of individual out there, somebody who comes into the ring with energy to take Unread to the next level, to take it to 2.0 and get that $60,000 next year.
And that's also one of those, you know, points about just sparking interest in the app and press. I mean, if you acquire an app, even if you don't do anything to the app except change the company name listing,
right,
you will get people that love the app to blog about that.
Yep.
And
it's, you know, sure, it's newsworthy implicitly.
Yeah. Yeah. And it should be. Yeah. And people get excited about it. They'll say, oh, there's a new future, a new life, new direction for the app. Yeah. You'll get a spike in sales just from that alone. Maybe it won't be huge, but it'll be at least there.
I'm going to make a shell company and sell my apps back and forth.
This week, Marzetta was sold again to Blue Sweater. I don't
right.
know.
Yeah, that's the problem too, though. We won't go down too much of a side tangent here, but there are some apps out there where it's like, really? It's being sold again? What is wrong with that app? Like, no developer seems to be able to hold on to it for more than 5 minutes.
Right. It's like that property or that house in the neighborhood that seems like always up for sale. I'm like, is it haunted? Like, is there no floor? I mean, what's wrong with this house? Every 6 months, someone's selling it again.
Right. So yeah, you definitely want to be careful. You can get a lot of buzz out of selling an app once. Sell me once, shame on me. Sell me twice, George W. Bush, ladies and gentlemen.
Right. Well, it'll be cool to watch. And yeah, I don't know. Maybe who knows what will happen with it. I think in the meantime, you know, like I said, I love the app. It will be on my home screen. Jared's other app, Repost for app.net, is also in my iPhone dock. It's not going to go anywhere off my phone because I love it, even though it's probably not going to even get any bug fix updates. And I don't know, the nice thing about the App Store too on iOS is that it's okay for an app to be fairly simple and do one thing.
Yeah.
And it's great if it's supported and new features are added, but if the app is nearly perfect as is, it's kind of okay if it stays that way for a while.
Yeah, I agree. But it's a missed opportunity for the developer, for the owner of that intellectual property, not to be. It's like the tap has just been like turned on halfway, and it's like somebody just needs to turn the tap the rest of the way. When you have this good of a first year, I mean, I keep harping on it, but I really do think it's good. When you have that good of a first year, $40,000 for your iOS app, right? Mm-hmm. That means there's pressure behind the tap. That means there's more where that came from. Because you don't, and it was only for sale for 6 months. Remember, it was 6 months of work on it, right? And then 6 months of selling it. You don't just exhaust all the $40,000 worth of people buying your app that is out there in a 6 month period. In that 6 month period, you didn't even reach the knowledge of the existence of the app, didn't even reach 99% or more of people who have an iPhone. So anyway, that's my pitch. Jared, you should sell it to somebody. Make a deal with them so they'll give you a kickback on a percentage of the sales, and then you'll get the best of both worlds, and your customers will have to look forward to 2.0, 3.0, et cetera, of Unread. That's my advice. I'm sticking to it. Judge Judy has made the verdict. Do I got stupid written on my forehead, Manton? I didn't think so.
I like it. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. If you have any feedback at Corrent.org or at Corrent on Twitter, app.net. And, of course, check out the Jobs Board, the sponsor this week. And that's at jobs.corrent.org.